come out at an angle. If you take a line from those arms forward, they meet up on the axle. And the reason for that was if you're on a slope, the implement starts to drag downhill, the action of the arms twists the implement to dig in uphill to the land and keeps it straight behind the tractor. So not only did he invent the hydraulic system, he did all that at the same time. Now the first one he built was, I think, 1936, and it's called the Black Tractor, and it's in the Science Museum. And then he got the David Brain Company to build tractors for him, and they did about 1,250, but they couldn't build them fast enough for Harry Ferguson, because he was going to push them all over the world. So he went and met Henry Ford in America, and showed him with a model his invention. They shook hands across the table and had a deal. Ford would build the tractors with Ferguson's system and Ferguson would market them. Well, that lasted a few years and then they fell out. Harry Ferguson came back and got the Standard Motor Company to build the tractors for him. In the meantime, Ford in America carried on building them and called them something else. And Harry Ferguson sued him for pinching his patent right. And in a long court battle, he won, and he was awarded £200,000. And that was in the early 1950. So, there we have it. That's a very story you've heard enough from me. Anybody got any questions?
Anybody got any questions for Bruce about tractors? I know there's probably some tractor aficionados here. Oh, no, seriously. Anybody got questions
I've
about
got
that?
A tractor question. Oh. Jen. What about driverless tractors?
For the
well, that's beyond me,
driverless tractors.
I think it's very sad the way things have gone, because everything's got so big now. The men have gone from the farm. There's no community spirit where we always work together. You've seen all the pictures of harvesting with loads of men having a bit of banter and a joke. And now one chap sits and goes on all day, and I know he's got his mobile phone, and he doesn't really see anybody, and the chap from the big other corner. So it's, I think, the times when I left school were much more fun. It was harder work, obviously, but they were much more fun then than it is today.
Bruce, when did they convert from steel wheels to rubber-type tractors?
Well, Alex Chalmers did that. It would have been in the 30s, I should think, late 20s, early 30s. And Alex Chalmers developed a rubber tyre. And they got a racing driver, I think it was Barney Oldfield, his name, to race a tractor on a circuit. And they souped it up, obviously, and I think he did like 68 miles an hour to show the efficiency of rubber tyres.
Yes, go on then.
When it first arise about the health factor of driving a tractor in the open as opposed to having an enclosed cab around the driver?
So when they start fitting cabs, you mean? Well, way back in the 50s, you could buy various cabs. Lamborn made a canvas covered cab. Which you could buy separate to the tractor, or you could have it fitted before you took delivery. Kept the weather out. But then the actual safety cab, I think, came out in the 70s. Because obviously with a cab on, and you tip the tractor over, you can't jump off. So there were several people killed that way. So then every tractor, I think from 1977, every new tractor, and to have a safety cab fitted.
Anybody else?
Mr. Bailey.
What's your favourite tractor, Mr. Horn? You're only going to have one.
One. It has to be. And David Brain 50D.
It's yours.
He's got one
already. Well, thank you very much, Bruce. That was very good. Right, we're going to assemble our other farming people.
people, if you would come. John, would you like to come and sit on your hay bale? Mark is here. And where's
Mark's
Tim
here.
And,
Tim, I'm afraid, has had to leave us.
Tim's left us. Here. What about Richard?
Richard Jones, come forward.
No, he's gone.
Oh, he's gone as well. The other five. What about Robert? Robert?
Philip's here somewhere.
Philip, where are you? Here he comes.
Yes.
We've got young farming
yes,
people
and
as well.
Speedy can come up.
Speedy can come up as well.
We just leave him in the end, shall we?
Yeah.
Well, a cabaret, please.
You're very nice, Philip.
Oh, yes.
Oh, Neil. Sorry, Neil. Yes. This is your bail. Well, by the way, we also have Roger here, Roger Palmer.
Yes, let Roger come up.
Who is the technical man with regard to farming. He's an agronomist.
And don't forget Sue, who says she doesn't want to come
up. And don't forget Sue and Mark in the front here. So we want to know why the road is so dirty up at Glynn, don't we?
Well, it doesn't go
right.
Anywhere, so what are you doing out there?
Questions, please. Anybody want to start us off? Yes, Mr. Coates.
Thank you, Martin. You hear a lot about grain moisture content. Could you explain to us why the moisture content in grain is an important matter?
Who'd like to talk about that?
Who'd like to talk about that?
John, he's got more grain than anybody else.
John, so think about the kitchen.
Did everybody hear the question? The question from Tony was, he wants to know why there's a problem, I think, between grain and moisture content. It's a simple matter of, well, there's two things, there's biology and physics, as far as I understand. Grain that is dry and cool lasts longer in store, in bulk store in particular, in those conditions. So if it is wet and warm, bugs will affect it, and they will thrive in the damp conditions. And those bugs are mostly funguses. Okay, but you also those conditions can also encourage insects, which are naturally occurring in the grain in the field. They come into the store with the grain. And they sometimes are in the grain store before you put the grain in there as well, if you haven't done your hygiene properly, which we all do, of course, because we have to tick a box on a piece of paper and say that we've done it. In those events, if the grain is too warm and it is on the wet side, then the bugs will multiply. They actually then produce heat themselves, and the process is reinforced. So I think I've talked more about biology than physics, but I think there's some physics in there somewhere as well, in as much as temperature and moisture are physical issues. Does that give you any idea? That answers your question, Tony.
But I think when grain goes to the mills, they will only accept it within certain moisture contents. And is there, while the grain is on your farm, is there also a fire risk if it's too hot and too wet?
I know that John Parker over at Wallaceburg told me many years ago that they had some grain in their very big silos in that rather extraordinary grain store that they used to have there opposite his house, that some grain in one of those bins got so hot that it did catch fire. That's the only time I've ever heard about it. It's pretty unusual for grain to catch fire in a silo, but it's not impossible, as he has testified to. I was going to say something else, I'm trying to think what it was now. The millers, yes. There are two aspects. Anybody who buys grain wants it as dry as possible because they don't want to buy water.
Yeah.
Okay, so there is an industry standard. And, you know, us farmers always feel we're on the losing side because they keep producing to the level of moisture all the time, which means we have to burn more diesel to dry it when we put it into our stores before it's subsequently loaded out into lorries and taken to the mills. But that's business for you. So anyway, I think I've hopefully answered your question.
Right, another question. The gentleman, the Brit, Robert.
Oh, hello there, yeah, okay. There's a great number of dog walking, now footpaths and driveways are probably on the land.
The question is, for dog walkers, are footpaths and driveways
a problem?
A problem for farmers. The dog walkers coming across the land on footpaths and driveways.
He's going to love this.
Official footpaths and driveways are not an issue. Unofficial land that is used by people is a huge problem. And we in the last few years, there have been government schemes to have wide headlands around the fields to encourage wildlife. Wildlife does not respond well to out-of-control dogs. And we have had innumerable instances of people claiming that they have walked that headland for X years. It is therefore in right of way, and they are entitled to walk it. They are not. The government scheme was a total failure as far as we're concerned. There was less wildlife in the hedgerows than there was previously. And we even had some people from this village who stopped one of our tractor drivers and told him he was breaking the law by spraying over their footpath, which was actually the headland of the field. I hope that answers the question.
What about fly tipping while we're on the same subject? Is that a problem?
Why is it the same subject, Pat?
No, it's not the same subject.
Do you want to be
the dog
Sorry, bad question. Fly tipping, is it a problem?
The question's about fly tipping. Gentlemen, do we suffer badly this year in your farm?
Yes.
In the farms? I know we see it on the side of the main roads, but...
There is a problem in the countryside with fly tipping for a number of reasons. We do have organised recycling centres, but there are a lot of job and builder sites. Some garden... maintenance people, but they're too loyal to go to the recycling centre, and or the recycling centre fees are too great, and I believe the local authorities are wrong by not encouraging them to sensibly at recycling centres anyway. But it's all too often, certainly around the outskirts of Hamilton, that one sees all sorts of builders' materials and old tyres, also anything you can think of, even the old broken toilet sometimes one sees it around the countryside. It's not good, it ought to be stamped out.
It's not the nicest of subjects. It is inevitably political to some extent because the government introduced fees for which local authorities have to charge. Those fees keep going up. In fact, just gone up very recently, and we've had an increase in fly tipping on our land. There's all sorts of ways in which it suddenly appears. Very often they'll drive along the road, somebody will be in the back of the truck or whatever it is, throwing it out, so you have a line of it all the way down the side of the field or just inside the field. Sometimes they'll back in and tip it up. Sometimes they won't even tip it in on the verge or in the field. They'll tip it up in the middle of the road. I can tell you on one occasion several years ago now, I was driving a tractor with a plough down the lane from Chidden towards the Baton Ball. I came round the corner and down the hill and had to put the anchors on very quickly because there was a huge pile of thuya cuttings that were literally just lying in the road. It was about 4 o'clock on a Friday afternoon, and I shot back to the farm as quickly as I could, rang the local authority thinking they all have gone home now, it's a Friday, and actually fortunately Although it was just on the Winchester City side of the boundary, the East Hampshire people in the council were responsible for dealing with this sort of emergency. We're out there by 5 o'clock clearing up, so they did a fantastic job. But the ratepayers paid. And what had happened is they started throwing it on the verge because there was some of this enormous, I cannot tell you how much it was, on the verge, and they suddenly realised this is taking too long. Pull the plug and tip it up in the middle of the road. And if somebody else had come round the corner, particularly in the opposite direction in a car, there would have been a very, very serious accident. Somebody would have been seriously hurt. So it was just lucky that I was the first one there in a relatively slow moving vehicle. But this is the sort of serious aspect to it that everybody should be trying to do what they can to encourage local authorities or even talk to MPs about how serious a matter it is, and the government have got to get engaged. It really is at that level.
Thank
you. Oh, Murray's got one. Thank you, everybody. I saw Sharon's hand go up just now before Murray got in. Fire away, Sharon.
Can I go back to footpaths? If I'm on a path and I approach a field that's got cows in it, and the path goes right through the herd, what do? Do I turn around and go back? Blindly go toward the cows? Or do I skirt around the edge close to the fence where if they start getting fractious I can hopefully haul myself over?
You walk over the footpath.
Even through...
As long as there's not a bullet in there, you are going to be perfectly safe. Cattle tend to be inquisitive animals and will come towards you. But actually, they're normally totally safe. The only problem you may have is if there is a bull. And normally nowadays, when Philip might be able to correct you, John, but keep your name at the mark if there's a bull in the field.
Yes. Yeah.
Which you never used to, in which case you'd probably be advised to find a different footpath. But seriously, if it's a bunch of young cattle, they're more interested in literally walking along behind you. They're not going to harm you. Unless you've got a dog that starts yapping, potentially chasing at them, etc. But normally, you should. That is the right of way. It does not give you right to deviate from the right of way, because that would be some cattle in the field.
I think you should keep a dog on a lead as well.
Yes.
Yeah, dogs are always
around. They will tend to agitate them.
Of course. Murray.
And this is not a political question. I've just been loving exploring the history of farming here in the area around Hamilton. But as a representative group of farming people, I'd like to know what your thoughts are about the future of farming and whether the about to happen changes in our relationship to Europe are going to lead to a return to some values that have been lost, or whether you think it's going to put even more pressure on an endangered community. And I don't want it to be a political question, I think it's a purely practical question about our farming heritage.
Anybody feel up to that?
Who wants to be the politician tonight? I believe that there has been a farming for a long time, and there will be for a long time. I think things will change, and I think probably after Brexit it will eventually settle down and will be better. I think at the moment farming is curtailed by all the regulation that comes through from Brussels, or from the EU anyway. And I think we won't turn the clock back to the 70s, but we will adjust. And farmers have always been adaptable, and I'm sure they'll be adaptable again.
Murray, you used the word values, I think, didn't you? What did you mean by that?
Well, the bottom line is whether we want to benefit from the global economy as consumers, or whether we're ready to invest in the policy that keeps us independent. And I don't think that this is an understood kind of equation going on in the minds of some British people. The only way that we're going to get value back into our farming community is by being willing to pay a rate that's viable to allow them to conduct their work and business in a way that is, that keeps them alive.
So by value, you meant monetary value?
I meant the traditional values of looking after the land and having an independent economy, as well as the economics of it.
How many hours have you got? farmers, all generations of farmers like to think they're looking after the land. Different generations look after it in different ways, and that's as much to do with science and technology, you know, the changes in science and technology as anything else. In terms of, is the British public going to respond in the way that perhaps Murray was just suggesting? All I can say is that there have been surveys done. In fact, there's a lady who works for the BBC, is often on the farming programme, who was had a little series about Brexit and farming on Radio 4 quite recently, who reminded her listeners, if you like, on one particular occasion, that she'd done many surveys of shoppers as they were about to enter supermarkets, asking them what their values were in terms of the quality of the food and the type of food. Would they buy British? And, you know, there are free-range eggs in this supermarket, and there are non-free-range, okay? Before they went in, will you buy the free-range eggs? And they all said yes. They were interviewed as they came out. It was a proper, formal process, albeit, you know, done on friendly terms. And sure enough, they bought the non-free-range because they were cheaper. So nine times out of ten, price wins through, and I think none of us are guilty of anything in that. It's just a fact of life. So in terms of trying to establish whether the consumer is going to support British farming by paying more for their food, the evidence tends to not be the case, but who knows whether that's an interesting response or not.
I mean, I got some thoughts on it. I mean, and it's my, I'm the one who decided not to stay in farming. My brother obviously does farm, and he was very much for Remain. They first point about the EU regulations, but he actually quite liked the EU funding. And said we would never ever go back to where we were before we went into the EEC. And that could never happen again. I come from a different perspective. Subsidies were brought in after the war to actually pay farmers to produce goods so that we as a country could be as self-sufficient as possible, which was proven in the Second World War. And I was reading an article the other day, our level of self-sufficiency today is far, far lower than it was in the Second World War. And we potentially could have a problem if we were to ever go back into that scenario. And the article was arguing that actually subsidies need to be maintained to encourage farmers to grow those crops which the consumer expects to pay a pittance for. Prepared to pay an awful lot for a bottle of rainwater in a plastic bottle, but he doesn't want to pay much, as we've said, for his eggs, or his bread, or his milk. And so it is a huge debate, and it would be one of the things, I'm sure, which features large in Britex negotiations. But on an interesting, another sort of side of it, I don't know if some of you watch Country Farm on Sunday night, they've just done a series talking to New Zealand farmers. For those of you who haven't, and those of you who've seen it, I apologise. But New Zealand farmers, when we joined the EEC, suddenly got told that they were going to lose all their subsidies. And that happened over a period. And New Zealand farming now survives without subsidies. They have had to modify how they farm. They've had to change their perspective on various things. And they're very happy that they think they can survive without subsidies. But it is an interesting dilemma. And of course, it will all depend again on the Britex negotiations, not necessarily Europe, but actually who we will trade with and what they're prepared to pay.
Thank you, gentlemen. That's a pretty comprehensive. Robert, as we've had, is this a follow-on?
Yes, follow-on. Yeah. Can I just throw the word genetic modified crops?
I just wanted to ask that. Maybe Roger would like to talk to us about this because he's GM, Roger.
Right. Yeah. Well, firstly, let me declare an interest in that I have acted as a consultant to Monsanto, a company that's deeply involved in genetic modification of crops, but not on that particular topic. The issue of GM is an interesting one in that we take quite a sort of moral view about GM here in Europe with Franken foods and things like that. If you go to the US, GM foods are very, very widely grown and it's perfectly normal. If you go to Asia and talk to farmers over there, as I have, they cannot understand our attitude to genetic modification because, of course, they see that as a valuable technology to enable them to produce the food that they desperately need in those countries. Really, you know, it's an extraordinary thing. I can well remember when Monsanto bought PBI in Cambridge, the Plant Breeding Institute. They paid £676 million for it, I believe, and it was to be their launch pad for GM into Europe. And an enormous fracas subsequently ensued, as I'm sure you all remember. But the thing that fascinated me about that was that the debate took place in the complete absence of any science. There was no discussion about science, it was all driven by emotion. And, you know, it just struck me that that debate was taking place by people who had plenty of cheap food to eat and saw no need for genetically modified crops. At the end of the day, genes are only proteins, and proteins are digested. There's absolutely no scientific evidence to suggest that there's any harm to human beings. But, you know, why let the facts spoil a good discussion? I can understand the concerns that surround it. And in particular, of course, the idea of genetically modified crops escaping into the environment. So if you've got, say, herbicide-resistant crops that escape, you could then have a significant weed problem somewhere else. So it is a valid issue, but we cannot stop technology. In particular, this is a very valuable technology for us. And I can remember working with ICR, my very first job as a research scientist, and we had a department then which was devoted to chemically sterilising plants in order to produce hybrids, something which can be done very much more easily by genetic modification now. And that has contributed significantly to the opportunity to increase yields and also, and perhaps even more importantly, to consistently produce crops. The agriculture, of course, takes place in the wider environment. And as we've seen with vegetable crops in Spain, that's something you're short at the moment, thanks to the climate. The variations in yields are almost as important as the absolute yield itself. So I think all of these technologies have a role to play, and it's a matter of some regret to me that so many people seem to be almost scientifically illiterate and fail to understand the issues. And equally, those companies which are working with these technologies singularly fail to understand that we live in a world which is driven as much by emotion as it is by an understanding of the technology involved.
Thanks, Roger. Good answer. Thank you. Right, now, Bob was sitting first. Bob, fire away.
Can I ask, and once we're out of Europe, will farmers still be paid for set-aside then?
Oh, gosh. Does anybody know the answer to that?
The answer is we don't know, but highly unlikely.
Did you hear that? The answer is we don't really know, but it's highly unlikely, Philip. Have we paid for the farmers get some money for set aside?
There is some set aside that technically set aside does not exist anymore.
There's lots of other environmental
things called ecological focus area.
Ecological focus area,
which is akin to set aside from a practical point of view, but it's not called that, and the sort of subsidy attached to it is different because it's tied in with subsidies you get on land that you can use for normal cropping processes. You don't want to ask because it is unbelievably complicated.
All tied up with subsidies and where the subsidies will come from after Brexit. Okay. Right, Caroline?
I was wondering about economies of scale, because on the one hand, economies of scale bring great benefits, but on the other hand, do they bring disbenefits because you don't get mixed crops or the wildlife or whatever that goes with that? I mean, I've heard that it's a problem in India, but we're talking about England here before. But is there a same problem here?
We're talking about scale of farming, sizes of... Roger's got his hand up.
Yeah, well, certainly the larger the field and the larger the farm, the more opportunities there are for economies of scale. And that's actually a really important factor, because if you look at Europe, we were just talking about Europe a moment ago, particularly in France, where inheritance operated under what was called the Code Napoleon system, whereby instead of the eldest son taking on the farm, and then the next son going into the military, and the third one becoming a vicar. Now, I don't know what the fourth one is, but in France, the farm was divided equally amongst all the offspring. So what you ended up with was lots and lots of very small fields. And the average farm in France, at one time anyway, comprised 11 different lots of land, often separated and distributed around, perhaps just a few acres in each field. So hugely, hugely uneconomic. And the reason why subsidies are so high to agriculture in the European community is because of the need, or the driver, it's a socio-economic need to keep people employed and to keep the land gainfully productive. So a really big difference to, you know, the cheap food policy that we have here in the UK. Now, of course, if you take that to the extreme, you end up with some of the places that I'm familiar with in East Anglia, which are arable deserts. You know, there's no hedges, there's no ditches, there's no trees. You've got literally fields of hundreds of acres in certain parts of Suffolk. Now, everything is a compromise, isn't it? Everything is a trade-off. Do we go back to the days of the Norfolk four-course rotation, where we've got boys following horses with ploughs and men with horses? Or do we accept that there is a need to be economically productive, but at the same time recognise the need for stewardship of the countryside? And I think many places we get that about right, and we're getting that increasingly right here in the UK. I'm Governor of Sparshall College, and the ecological and land management programmes there are extremely popular, and the students get very good jobs as a result of it. So, you know, it is inevitably a matter of some compromise, and the government has a role to play in that, in the way that they support agriculture post Brexit.
Philip, I think, was to add here.
Roger's given a very good overview on that. From a practical farmer's point of view, I have the privilege of employing a management consultant who I've known for a long time now, and we often talk about economies of scale, and I'm going to sort of give a little bit of a game away here, but he sees many, many businesses, both arable, dairy, and sheep, because he works in the West Country as well. And he says, as a firm, and they are a nationwide firm of management consultants, they find it very difficult to be able to pinpoint economies of scale across businesses. More often than not, what is important to the businesses that are efficient in terms of economic terms, is either the person who runs the business is actually doing all the work, in which case their costs are very low, or, if in the case of bigger businesses, the management in those bigger businesses is super duper, and that they get a huge amount of work out of their workforce and the machinery and the labour that they employ. But part of the point that he's trying to make is that actually labour and machinery in farming, and particularly in animal farming, are a trade-off, and the labour tends to be expensive some of the time, and machinery not so expensive, and very often it turns the other way as well. So actually, you can be big, and I'm farming quite a few acres, and we don't necessarily get the bottom line that we expect, and that is because our costs are too high, either because we need too many people to do the job, or the machinery that we buy and have to depreciate is too expensive at the point of purchase. So there's a lot of uncertainty about economies of scale. But the reality is that actually farms cannot get smaller again, going backwards to the old values, if one wants to use that word, because there are simply not the people to do the work anymore. And looking at economies of scale going forward, I think one's going to be looking at a slightly different concept, which is very much based on the shortage of skilled labour to actually do the work. Now, I mentioned earlier about farmers that do the work themselves tend to actually be into good economies of scale because they're basically not paying somebody else to do it. The more acres you've got, the harder that becomes. There are some very active farmers who are doing themselves on relatively large acreages, with some help, of course. But that isn't going to be the case, because there aren't simply aren't enough people, so there'll be a picking and choosing process that people will be farming large acreages with extremely big machines. Eventually, we may not see it in our lifetime, but it will happen, or there won't be any farming at all. It's one or the other, actually, I think. So it's all about economics. Every business is different, but one thing's for certain, farms won't get any smaller. I hope you find that interesting at the moment.
I wanted to ask Sue and Mark about the economy of scale milking herds and how that's changed over the years, Mark. How many did you milk when you first came here?
Excuse me. We brought 100 head of cattle up with us when we first came to Glidden. 7 or 8, might be 10 of them, didn't acclimatise. Since then, the sons have gone on, well, they do the job now, and they've upped their herd to somewhere about 240, I think it is. The price of milk hasn't done us any good. It's only the case that we rear all the young stock instead of just slaughtering them as they're born. They've all been reared and sold off at stores. Yeah. And that is another monthly check, if you like, which makes an awful lot of difference.
So in the old days, were the young stock slaughtered?
I can't remember when it came in, but I know that one time they turned around and, price of milk got so cheap that they didn't want young calves or anything, so they were slaughtered. It was uneconomical to rear them. But our sons, with their wisdom, they decided, right, we'd keep everything.
Yeah.
Then about 14 months they go up to, and then they sell them as stores.
Great.
And that's a very good extra milk check.
Thanks, Mike. That's great. So there we are. Let's. Yes, Sue's going to add something to that.
It's something that worries me. Sparshot is supposed to be a leader in what it does, but why the hell did it give up bees? I think bees are important. Are they or do I squash you? One on the wing.
Thank you very much.
Would you know the answer to that question?
Yeah, well, I'm so grateful for that question. My father was a beekeeper, and the next time I see the principal of Sparshell College, I will ask him and I will let you know.
You go down to lunch with one that was there when it gave it up soon. The Sparshell reunion, which there's only a very few of the oldies left. But I complained then, complained to Sparshot. But Heather Kill said, if I'd known that was happening at Sparshot, right on our doorstep, we could have brought it up in London at the meeting. But she didn't know that Sparshot was giving up bees. And I thought it was stupid. Why have fish and not bees?
Well, I
he doesn't answer that.
Don't understand it.
Why do we have fish? Well, there's lots of reasons why we have fish, believe you me. Bees are important as well. In fact, bees are extremely important these days for entirely other reasons. But let's not get into it.
A new question? Oh, John, that's the word about colony of scale.
Before we get too far away from the colony of scale and so on, we must remember that the population keeps getting bigger. And a landmass productive. Landmass is getting smaller. So, rightly or wrongly, but that's the way it's going, that there will be larger farms and larger fields ready to produce enough food to keep the population fed.
Makes common sense, doesn't it? Jan's got his hand up here, Heather, first maybe.
No, yeah. I've noticed around here that dairy farms seem to be disappearing. Milk production seems to be going down. And I was in Wales not too long ago, and we're standing on some land, and a gentleman pointed down and he says, that big milk truck you see going through here is the last one that calls on any of these dairies. And tonight, when you have tea at my house, the milk will come from France. Mm. Yes. Now, how much milk actually comes from France or from outside of the UK?
Anybody know?
That's all I can say.
So we are actually importing raw milk. Is that because
there's something going on
in the social environment? Yeah.
Bruce has a question.
Bruce is
going
to. Right, Bruce is coming up to give us some light on this one.
Right, there's never been any evidence of milk coming in from the continent. Milk products, butter, cheese, yogurt, you name it, come in by the boatload, but actual liquid milk is too expensive to transport across the water. So I'm not saying there's never been a tankload of milk coming, but it's all a myth. No one has ever got any proof that it's coming.
Well, there we are, that's a straightforward answer.
Can I just say?
Yes, please.
Just something about dairy farming in this actual immediate area. It's generally well known the number of dairy farmers goes dry and down by thousands at a time every year. But actually in this neck of the wood, I have to keep reminding myself there are still quite a few dairy farmers around here, and two of them are right next to the neighbours of mine, and that's good to see. I hope they continue doing what they're doing, because if they don't, they'll plough their acres and growing more corn, which means that's competition for me. But it's good to see as many dairy herds as there are in this immediate locality, so that's an important thing.
Good to know. Heather?
If the worst should happen, and we in a war situation, as you were when I grew up, do you think we can survive without importing food across the water as we did in the past? My father was involved very much in that. And my mother, who was a farmer's daughter, managed to keep us fed by her home growing and poultry and rabbit small holding.
So we're not all going to grow rabbits.
What about people in this country now? How could they?
Can we be self-sufficient? This is what you're asking.
Can we be self-sufficient? It's a big worry.
Sorry, do you mind if I say some more? I said a lot already.
No, it's a very interesting one because actually it's also tied up with the Brexit arguments and the question of, you know, whether agriculture should be supported in this country. People have talked about the war aspect a lot and the fact that, you know, maybe British agriculture should still be subsidised after Brexit. We hope that we won't be thrown to the wall, certainly, but times are very different in all sorts of different ways if one uses the wartime comparison. The first thing is that generals always fight the last war, they don't fight the war that's to come in their planning. Nobody knows what sort of war it'll be. We all probably think that it might be a press of a button, nuclear bomb, and, you know, a whole proportion of Britain is gone and the rest is contaminated, in which case there won't be any for any agriculture anyway. Who knows? But we can probably also assume that the sort of submarine war that we all know about in the North Atlantic is not likely to happen either. In which case, the sort of the sinking of all the tonnage and all that knock-on effect to getting food into this country, it just won't be the same. And I'm not a militarist, so I have no idea what the answer to that is. But the experts need to understand that, whether they will or not, and then advise government accordingly. Who knows? But there's a much more interesting aspect to agriculture now. It's very international in terms of the way that we produce food. So we do rely on fertilizers, modern pesticides, other techniques, tractors, you know, very expensive tractors and all that. Most of those inputs, I'm going to call them, are imported. So you can intend to be self-sufficient, but if you haven't got the fertilizer or the spray or whatever it is that's needed to make that crop grow, because that can't be imported, actually, you're in big trouble. It's not a necessary good sign, because, you know, the chemical industry, Roger would cut his teeth in and all the rest of it. Most of it's gone abroad now. All the tractors are imported now, only the single tractor made in this country. And you've got to throw all those things into the mix. So it's not a very pretty picture, it's a pretty good mess, really, but it makes the concept of self-sufficiency much more difficult to get your head around. I think that's about as much as I can say about it.
Why will I account yet then? You won't be able to rely on all this fertiliser. You might not
is that yes, actually, you might want to be producing your pigs and your rabbits and your chickens in your back garden again. That is probably the most important thing that anybody can do to have a hope.
Okay, folks, you got the message.
Does Roger
want to stand up again? Anybody else? Tony, please.
It was really to make a bit of a statement, if I may.
Oh, no, we don't want to.
Here we go.
Hang on.
But from about the 1880s up to about the 1930s, agriculture was in the doldrums. But in 1917, this country was within 6 weeks of starving as a result of the U-boat war in the First World War. By the time the Second World War came, we were much more self-sufficient. I believe in the 1900s, 1917, we were only producing about 20% of our own food. And by now, I was reading a recent NFU Countryside magazine, we produce about 60% of our own food. And I think that puts it a bit more in context. And I was talking to a well-known greengrocer, retailer, wholesaler locally, and asking him about where the new potatoes came from. Because when I were at that, I came from Egypt, Cyprus, Jersey, Guernsey, and then Pembrokeshire before we got local ones. But he tells me now that modern storage methods are such that all the new potatoes he sells are all British new potatoes. And there's lots of other things that we can do in the same way, whether we grow more coxes, apples, and more russets, rather than importing some of those nasty things from Europe. Thank you very much.
What I was trying to say is, about 15 years ago when I was instructed at Orbish on the science at Shogun, we actually had various nuclear sources to do government trials. And if I said to you that it was possible for us to store a fresh tomato for 2 years and then serve it, you would tell me I was barking.
Tastes like it sometimes.
That is what was happening. By actually irradiating fresh food. Yeah. I know it sounds quite remarkable. You can actually store it for a considerably longer time than anyone would ever dream it. But, like what Roger said with GM, how many of you ladies would go into Morrison's, who do sell new potatoes from Egypt and everywhere else, if you were given the chance of a 2-year-old British tomato that had been irradiated, or one from Iraq, I know which one you'd buy. And again, it's this mental adjustment that you have to make. The other thing I'd say about self-sufficiency is actually we would not have survived the Second World War without food imports. And of course, one thing to remember is the population in the Second World War was the healthiest it had ever been. Obesity would become a thing of the past.
Any other questions? Any more questions, please? Have we got any ready up our sleeve, or should we...
No, I think the Speedy would like to just have a little word about the young farmers, please.
Yes, Speedy would like to just have a word. And when he's had a word, I wonder whether Robert would like to speak about the records office as well.
Yeah.
Of course,
yes. Gentlemen, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. This is just to let you know that South East Camp's Young Farmers Club is alive and well living in your area. Who in this room was a young farmer once?
All right.
Hands up. Come on, hands up. Don't be shy. Mr. Taylor, so when Mr. Taylor was very good after dinner speaker, probably 10 or a dozen or 15 years ago, perhaps, at our dinner and dance. As soon as I walked in the room tonight, my logo was instantly recognised by Mr. Swinburne from Snowdrop Cottage opposite Lot's shop, and he told me that he was once chairman of the Young Farmers Club many years ago. This is our current club chairman, Henry Stride. Hello, Henry.
Hello.
He's not shy.
Speedy drew me up here about 2 minutes ago. I wasn't really sort of prepared for this, but yeah, how many members have we got at the moment? 30 members?
Where's the treasurer?
31. 31 members. We seem to have a weekly meet, which we get a good sort of, I don't know, probably 8, 10, 15 people along to most times. We try and do something every week. Gosh. We have a break in the summer. I don't know, is there any other bits we can add? We have a few oldies that come along, like Speedy.
Really?
Have we got any ladies?
Yeah, there's a few there.
Can I just say something?
Yeah.
Of course you can, Madam Vice President.
I'm not.
Have we left you off the list?
Mr. Speedy Bay, when he first joined the Young Farms, he could hardly put one word in front of the other. You really want to hear him give a speech now. It is fantastic. And we thank the Young Farmers team. Isn't that right?
You're dead right. You're dead right.
Not a very one.
You might not think
much of what I'm going to say, because we're going to draw you into a little tale. You don't have to be one to be one. If anybody wants to join, Henry, me, I'm a club leader. I've been a club leader now for since I was 26. I've never not been a club leader. I've been chairman and treasurer. I'm also, at the moment, blowing my own trumpet, president-elect of Hampshire County Young Farmers. And they keep me young. I know. My children go, my daughter is a secretary. We've got Piers Galloway down there, he's still at school at Swarmore. He's hopefully learning something and he's going to be a boffin one day. We've got Ed Cooper at the back there. He welds, he's very good welding, he fences, and he's very good at catching moles.
Oh, right. Come and see me
up. We've got Liam Harvey there. Liam is self-employed agricultural contractor from Wolf and Chase. And he will carry your fields and tear up your paddocks and enter your manure trailers and make hay for you and all sorts of things. And Lucy Bain, my daughter, works in a restaurant in Wickham called Lily's. But anyway, when the Young Farmers were meeting, this is a completely true story, I'm going to draw you in on this one. We went to the batting ball the other night and we had some old farmers in there. And the old farmers were there with their wives. And they, Mrs. Hartnett's laughing because she's already heard this one, so it's gone. I do apologise to Mrs. Hartnett. The men were sat in one corner on the table discussing exciting things like Brexit and the price of weeds and, you know, what new combines are. And the ladies were sat on another table and they were comparing their husbands' performances to tractors. Now, if you know about tractors, you'll get the idea about tractors in a minute. Now, Mrs. White, she was sat there at the table and she said, well, my Philip, well, he's like a John Deere, a big, powerful tractor. And if conditions are right, he'll sow his seeds all night, she said. So, interesting. And Mrs. Harnett, she was there, and she said, well, my John, he's a bit like a Massey Ferguson. When we're getting down to business, he goes bright red, but he's always up first over the finishing line. It's very unfortunate, but that's fine. And so we then get to Mr. Sylvester. Sue was there, and she said, well, my Mark, he's a bit of a Zeta. Which is an Eastern Bloc type tractor. It's a Robin Reliant of the tractor, right? And she says it's a little bit of a job to get him going, and it's a bit of a pum pum pum, and then he conks out halfway through. But Gillian Horn was there. She threw back her hair. She said, My Bruce is like a vintage tractor. The other ladies leaned in. They were jealous and envious. And they were thinking, steady and slow and mature. And she said, no, he only gets it out once a year and then has to be had started.
True. That will bring our question and answer session with the farmers to an end. I'd like to thank Philip and John and Neil and Roger and Mark and Sue here for being our expert panel. Thank you very much, gentlemen. We've been fortunate this evening. Oh, hang on, Mark, you might say something.
On behalf of everybody, I'd like to thank the gang who put this lot together very heartily. They've done a wonderful job, I consider, and as for Martin, well, he's just no different than the ever is.
I'll say some thank yous in a little while, but I did want to give Robert a chance to say a few things. He's brought a lot of pamphlets here to do with the Hampshire Records Office. Both Pat and Caroline have been to the Records Office and seen what they do there. I have not. I've yet to be educated in that way. And it's important to know what they do. And maybe, Robert, you could just give us 5 minutes, a few words about how important the record office is to being our archive.
Okay, well, I was going to say, I've never been to a local history meeting as good as this, or as different as this, and then the young farmer there again.
End story, so...
We didn't expect
wonderful. So I get the simple one. Okay, so it took me about 5 minutes to read, but Hampshire Archive Collection is second to none. The archives of the wider county are held in the Hampshire Record Office in Winchester, and Portsmouth and Southampton have their own archives. It both brings the past to life and helps us understand and interpret the present. Archives can be fragile. Some discover are centuries old, but all are at risk from poor storage, overhandling, or just the failure to realise the value is evidence. In the last 50 years, archive work undertaken by the Hampshire Records Office and more recently by the Hampshire Archive Trust, who by spreading the word between them managed to protect much of Hampshire's archive heritage. Societies such as your own have done much to contribute to this achievement by ensuring newly discovered material is deposited at the archive, or by depositing their own materials. Hampshire Record Office, or in its latest guise, Hampshire Archives and Local Studies, is situated in an iconic building in Sussex Street, just across from Winchester Railway Station. This allows the archivist to store the archives in secure, humidity and temperature-controlled environments, conserve when necessary, and to copy as much to ensure, therefore, that the material is accessible, and this is important, and free of charge for the public to see. The archive is very diverse. It ranges from great estate records, the Bishops of Winchester, with pipe rolls dating back to 1208, to CD recordings of our regional orchestras. The archive continues to grow with the deposit of newly found older material, whilst the modern aspect of the archive is also increasing, with the records of businesses, societies, and churches, etc., being deposited. Now, just a small plug for my current sphere of activity in the record office. The word archive brings to mind parchments, maps, plans, parish records, property deeds, letters, diaries, even newspapers and photographs. All these are in the archive. However, beginning at the end of the late 19th century, we have new archive material, audio and visual recordings, and we've seen that here this evening. I had a wonderful time taking sample material from the Wessex Film and Sound Archive, which has its own separate area within the Hampshire Record Office around this fine county of ours. This part of the archive now has over 36,000 deposits, and it vividly conveys the life and time of our ancestors, from scenes of war and ocean travel, as well as farming practices, to the millennium celebrations. But back to the Record Office, there is still much to do. To continue to discover further archive material and to stop its destruction, including modern records, whose importance is often not recognised, and this includes digital records. To stop both collections or individual material being sold, both outside the county or even worse, abroad. And to stop the overuse of original archive material by introducing an extended copying programme, which will again help the archive to be made more widely available. So very much thanks for inviting me this evening. Grateful. Thank you.
Thank you, Robert. Thank you very much. Thank you. And it doesn't mean that once stuff is in the records office, that it is gone from our grasp, as it were. It can still be accessed. It can still be brought out from the records office because you bring stuff out and
you can take displays,
take copies and all that. So it's not lost forever. So don't dump all your family photographs or anything like that. It's too valuable.
Right, I'd like to wind up the evening now by saying a few thank yous. We said thank you already to our farming folk. Oh no, there was a couple of objects over here on the mystery. Everybody knew what all those things were. They're pretty obvious, weren't they, really? I don't think so. There's a couple there, answers that Pat's got here that...
Just two jumpers could be made from that fleece, I'm afraid. So, not very many. And just to say that from that sack, you could make 22 loaves. From the trailer, 23,800 loaves. Just so you know.
And the loaf of bread, what was that?
No, that was...
Never mind. Right, big thank you. Thank you to everybody who's worked so hard to create this evening. There are two or three particular... There's a small team for the local history group at the moment, and a lot of work's been done by Pat and Stephen and Caroline and Murray. There are four key players. John and I also do our bit to support as much as we can. But all these wonderful photographs have been produced by Murray and his team, and David Webb has helped us with printing a lot of these photographs as well. And if in future you'd like to get involved, we're still happy for people to get involved. Transport will be our next element that we want to concentrate on. There's some old millennium pictures of transport on one of the boards. So that's the future. We're moving on to transport next. Thank you all very much for coming, and a big, big thank you to the team that has set this all up. Helped also wonderfully by Jill and Bruce, who've been tremendous with all their wonderful stuff as well. Thank you all for coming and making this such a super evening.
Thanks,
should have all of it, including the